This is the beginning of class 10.
Sanshi Bhurki Jushin Eto Jam Rira Vinshi Nyende Nyampadi Sangye Shindu Mithe Uwagi Jogu Nanda Shimla Jepa Sangye Chodam Sangye Chodamma Chanchu Badu Dagni Kyatsu Chi Dagi Chunyen Pipe Sunangki Drola Penche Sangye Chupasho Sangye Chodam Sangye Chodamma Jubadu dami kasuchi Dagi chumyen kipe sunangi Jola penche sangye jubasho Sangye chudam sangye chudama Jubadu dami Suchi Dahi Chunyen Kipe Sunamki Yola Penche Sangye Jubasho.
Second?
I have a practice in the phone.
Yeah, I should take it. And then just before that, there was a section on
he's answering.
Well, there's subdivisions of how to take a llama. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. And then after that, how to act after you take a llama? And how to purify yourself? There were three divisions. What were those?
Three divisions of how to purify yourself?
Yeah. How
small
to practice.
Small capacity.
Yeah, small capacity. Okay. Yeah.
I knew that answer because of the notes, but I didn't get what it meant.
I'm about to tell you.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Basically, it's this: a small capacity person, which means lesser capacity person, is practicing in order to avoid going to one of the three realms of suffering after he dies. Mm. Person of small scope or capacity is trying to avoid going to the three realms of suffering after you die. So those are what?
The lower realms.
Yeah.
Hell.
Yeah.
Hungry ghosts.
Can you see them?
One.
Only one. You can only see animals. Can you? Do you believe that you could be born as an animal? Probably not. Or you believe it, or you have some kind of a you have some kind of inclination to believe it, but do you have any logical proof which is so good that you could prove it to someone else?
No.
Unlikely. We'll try to work on that next course. But it takes a lot of study just to reach the stage of a lesser person, a lesser scope. It starts with what? What were the two things in the lesser scope that we studied with?
Understanding.
I guess and calm.
Yeah. What? I mean, as a preliminary, you saw how lucky you are to be alive. You know, what good chance you have right now. And then the two meditations we had there, one was on death. Can you perceive that directly? Death. Yeah. I mean, you can perceive it directly in others, and you can perceive it correctly with logic in yourself. Yeah. I mean, you can perceive it directly in others, and you can perceive it correctly with logic in yourself. So, So you can see your death. You cannot see your death with your eyes. You can see your death with your reasoning, with your capacity to think. In a foolproof, airtight way, you can perceive your death. It's something that you can prove to yourself without any great leaps of faith. It's logical. It's you perceive it in others. We have no evidence that anyone hasn't died. We're getting older. The people around you have started to die. You know 3 or 4 friends or 10 or 20 friends who've died. You have no reason to believe that you would be any different. If you do a qigong about death, this is a fact. Your own death is a fact. Definitely you will not resemble yourself after death. You will not be very similar to what you are now. That you can perceive. As well as you can see, not be very similar to what you are now. That you can perceive. As well as you can see with your eyes, someone else dying. So you can see that. How about the second part? What was that second part? Death and
karma.
Yeah, study karma, which means once you know you're going to die, and that's not a leap of faith, that's a fact, then there's a question of what will happen. And then you have to study karma. And it's not enough to study karma by itself. Ultimately, to understand karma, you have to understand emptiness. And you have to understand this, the teachings of the mind-only school, which we won't go into right now. You'll get a good dose of it next course. And the mind, to understand correctly karma, you must understand emptiness and the teachings of the mind-only school on how karma is transmitted in your mind. So those are two things that are going to come. So basically, the person of a small capacity is he's aware of how fortunate he is now. He's aware that he's going to die. And he's considering what it would be like after he dies. And I told you this famous, this is why Hamlet, that thing is so famous, to be or not to be. The question is, should I kill myself or not? The to be or not to be means, should I exist or not? Or should I kill myself? And he goes through, it's a beautiful, you should reread it sometime. And he starts to do a qigong about it. He says, yeah, that would be nice, you know. Really, this life is just suffering. And everything is pain. And is it better for me to just stay here and suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune? You know, see my karma results go up and down like a roller coaster. Or should I just put an end to it and thereby dream? And then he says, dream. Oh, wait a minute. What if something goes on? You know, and then he starts to worry. He says, what will happen after I die? Maybe I will continue. So he decides, in the end of that little section, he decides not to kill himself because he doesn't know. He's not sure. He says, maybe the dream will go on. Maybe I have to go through this after I die. So I'll just wait. That's typical Hamlet because he can't make up his mind anymore. So that's a death meditation. He did a proper death meditation and he came to the conclusion that maybe it wasn't good because maybe there's something that will throw him somewhere that he doesn't want to be after he dies. And that's karma, in a way. So those are the two natural concerns of a person of lower capacity, lesser capacity. Have we reached that point? I mean, they're aware of how lucky they are. Mm-hmm. They're meditating on death. And they're wondering about what's going to happen after they die. And they're trying to take care of it. Have we mastered the lam rim of death meditation? No. I haven't. So I don't even qualify. My Buddhist practice doesn't even qualify as the lesson, as the minimum Buddhist practice. Mm. Because I'm not really doing it thinking about my death, motivated by my death and what's going to be after that. So I don't even qualify as a lam rim practitioner. You know. I mean, in a real sense. And there were ways of teaching lam rim that the teacher and the students would go to a cave until they really had death awareness. you know, and they wouldn't go on to the next step for a year or 2 years. There were ways of, there were traditions of doing it that way. But that would take us too long.
Michael, what were you saying? Death? I mean, we can intellectually understand it, but you mean feel that we're going to die?
I think to act every day and every hour as if you truly believe that you had to die and that it could happen in the next hour and that only Dharma would help you then. Do we act like that? Do we base our life? Do we behave based on that? Because those three are true. Those three are, at least the first two are undeniable. It's undeniable that you must die, and it's undeniable that you have no idea.
Yeah, but everybody, I mean,
today.
A lot of people, I think, will accept that. The difference, I think, is the feeling and the acting upon every moment in the consciousness. That's the difference, not understanding it. Wouldn't you say so?
No, I mean, it's fine. You have to understand it to act on it. But when I say
I understand, I'm going to die.
But you have to internalize it. You're not behaving every moment as if you're going to die today.
Okay.
When you do, you've reached the first person's level. But we don't. And I don't know if we ever will. I must be very fortunate. Unless you meditate on it. And then your behavior would change. If you truly believe the Pabonga says you don't pack up big suitcases if you know you're leaving in 5 minutes. You know what I mean? If you know you're leaving a place never to come back again, you don't paint the place and, you know, buy expensive curtains and put a big carpet in and then leave 5 minutes later. You don't waste the time or the money because you know you're not coming back. You know? And he said the monks in Lhasa, they come to Lhasa from the Eastern Tibet to study. They get their geshe and the intention is just to go back home. So, you know, a week before they're going home, they finish their geshe, they got everything finished. They don't start painting their rooms, you know. They're never coming back, and they know it. So, why waste much time on this? So that was the lesser person's meditation. Now we go to the middle person's meditations, which are was up here before. You have middle person, right?
Yeah.
So I'm not going to write it. Medium capacity, okay? Kebu Jing, medium capacity. Now we're going to discuss some of the thoughts that he has.
Well, you didn't write it in Tibetan, you only wrote it in English.
You wrote it in Tibetan last
time. It was up here in the... it was from the other class in the morning.
Michael?
Yeah.
What? It's all under the rubric of initiation. And why isn't there something specifically aimed at developing initiation that's set forth at this stage in this presentation?
It's coming. Right there.
You know, something as an aside to what you said about not being able to prove the existence of hell realms and hungry ghosts and other realities.
Oh, you can, but not...
Well, scientifically.
Not right now. We can, scientifically.
Well, the sign I was going to make was there's an article in the Times today that said physicists have proven that there's only between 1 and 10% of matter is visible.
Mm-hmm.
Measured. So
it's
90 to 99% of what they can scientifically measure as existent matter is beyond their perception.
Yeah. Like beyond your way. Visually. Tar stands for tarpa, which means moksha, which means freedom.
This is what?
This is the first lam rim for a person of medium capacity. Okay. He knows he's going to die. He already learned about karma. Now he's worried about something greater than that. So tar means freedom. Dhe means want. Lo means mind. And ke means to develop.
Michael?
Yeah.
I've read like Hindu philosophy, and it seems to me that what they call moksha is the same thing as nirvana. Is that true?
The word moksha is a synonym in Buddhist Sanskrit for nirvana. But all Hindu religions have the word, or most of them have the word moksha, meaning freedom. They all believe there is a freedom from cyclic existence. You know, they accept the idea. They don't claim that this is the method to reach that. They don't agree that this, that what we're studying is the method to reach that. They each have their own unusual idea about how to reach that. Some of them said, if you could meditate your whole life, jump off a cliff onto a three-pointed spear, and one went through here, and one went through here, and one went through here, with the right attitude, you would reach nirvana. Okay, and they get a little bit better off than that. So Tantra Lokya means, first of all, to get the very wish to achieve freedom from this kind of suffering.
Could you repeat that?
To develop the wish to be free from suffering, or to achieve freedom, I should say. To develop the wish to achieve freedom.
From all of suffering existence.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
Low means again?
Low means the idea or mind. To develop the state of mind, you can say, in which you wish to achieve freedom. It means to develop the wish to get out of here completely. And the text says here, Chepe Mingom Dunya Kundigo. Chepe Mingom means no matter how much you experience the pleasures of this life, you can't be satisfied. And it's worse than that. And he goes on, he has a long commentary about it. I think we can translate this sometime. This is Papoka's commentary to Tsongkhapa's text. And he says, the nature of any kind of happiness in this life is that it makes you more thirsty. And no one is ever satisfied. The nature of most every worldly thing that goes right is that it not only doesn't make you, it doesn't make you contented, it actually works against your contentment. Every time you get something good, eventually it just makes you want more than that.
Because you enjoyed it, you want it again, you see?
Not only that you want it again, but you want more. And it's not just the nature of heroin or alcohol, or it's the nature of promotions at work. It's the nature of relationships that you have with other people. It's the nature of food. It's the nature of everything. Every time you get one thing, then it makes you want more.
Is that the description of pervasive suffering?
It's part of it.
Is that an argument against doing things that are especially pleasing unless they relate specifically to Dhamma?
I think the Dalai Lama has a nice, and I think in general, good practitioners are sort of, they have good sense, which is lacking in poor practitioners. You know, people who don't practice very well don't have good sense. And people who are practicing very well are also blessed with good sense. So I don't think I've seen anyone who can enjoy himself better than the Dalai Lama. You know, I mean, or not many people. You know, he really enjoys things. But he has the right attitude. He perceives them as suffering. He knows they're suffering. And that's the basic, you know, should you deny yourself things that you want because they'll make you want more? It's not the point. You have to meditate until you perceive that this thing is not desirable. It's not to try to stop yourself from enjoying something which you perceive as pleasant. It's to understand its nature and no longer see it as pleasant. And you just won't want it, that thing anymore. We were talking about, I met a Mongolian monk yesterday, and he said the big problem in Mongolia right now is that none of the monks wants to be celibate. They all would like to have a wife. And this was apparently some corruption in Mongolia that has started a long time ago, and now it's a problem. And then he said, they just haven't seen, the thing is they haven't seen that it's not a desirable thing. See what I mean? They just didn't see that yet. That's why you become a monk. So that's just, you have to, it's not that you're trying to deny yourself something. It's just that you see that it's not going to bring you happiness or contentment over in the long run. It's just not, it's not its nature.
So everybody should become monks and nuns without just... So then what happens, isn't that a contradiction to say, oh, your parents, you should be, like, they're so good to you because they gave you life? What about that? I mean, isn't that's a little bit good. Of a contradiction there? I mean, you're saying this life is precious, but let's become monks and nuns and we're not having any kids anymore.
Oh, they got these test tubes
now. You still have to do some work on that.
You mean, Michael, like, everything... everything is unhappiness except for becoming a monk or a nun. Is that it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't agree with that.
You debate it. You debate it. I mean, you find something. You tell me.
Isn't it? It's got nothing to do with the person, the wife or the husband or the glass of... wonderful juice or something, isn't it just something in the mind of that person which makes them a samsaric person as opposed to a liberated
person? In the long
person.
Run, yes. In the
that's all there is to it.
Who is the wealthiest person in the world? It is a
samsara. It's a state of mind, really. It's got nothing to do with those.
What is samsara? You know the definition.
Being it's not a state of mind.
It's being afflicted with the five contaminated heaps.
No, you got to know what you're trying to get out of before you can get out of it. Most people never learn.
Most
people never learn what samsara is.
What is this, the definition then?
My state of mind.
Being forced to take on over and over again these five impure heaps which you've always done.
Disgust.
Aggregate.
Meaning.
Took the words right out of my mouth.
Your mind and your dirty mind and body. Which were created by karma. And it's okay to have a mind and body, but not one which was forced upon you by your past deeds, by your past perceptions, if you get deeply into it. That's about
it. Always done.
Okay. Chepi Miro, do we have to go? It is the door of every suffering. Yiten Miro, you can't trust them. Sipe Punto, the good things of this life. Okay. So the first thing is you have to recognize that the things that seem nice about this life, they are unstable, they cause you every pain you have, and they have a peculiar quality of making you dissatisfied and discontented.
Discontent.
That's their nature.
Can you tell me how you can, I think you mentioned the dialogue, how you can enjoy something and at the same time recognize it as suffering?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's difficult.
Difficult to understand for us.
That's what the Buddhists do.
I think it is. Well, part of the definition of that kind of desire is a wish not to be separated from that object. So, that's actually a definition of one of the three poisons, desire. It's a definition of the second of the third poisons, which is hatred, is the longing to be separated from something you don't like. It's a definition of those basic bad thoughts. That's their definition. So I believe that true enjoyment for the Dalai Lama would be, to answer your question, he. By the way, not only does he enjoy it, karmically, he can't avoid enjoying it. He doesn't have a choice. It's true that you have no choice when you're suffering, but the opposite is true too. If you keep doing good deeds, I'm sorry to tell you, enjoyment will be forced upon you. It's true. It's logical.
There's
this guilt trip about the negative part, but you can't avoid. If he threw the food down and walked out, there'd be more outside. There'd be more waiting for him. So I think he can enjoy it and be able to not develop desire for it by being immediately willing to leave it. And that's a sign.
No attachment.
It's like connect. That's the definition of desire. Yeah, being desire is the craving not to lose the object which you are enjoying. You can't eliminate all the enjoyable objects in the world, because if you're a good practitioner, they're loading themselves on you more and more as you go through your life. If you're a very kind person in the early part of your life, you are forced to meet good people later in your life and have nice things happen, basically. So there's not this thing where a good Buddhist has to avoid enjoying things, but you also can't do anything immoral to to keep it or you shouldn't. You know, if somebody's wife says, "Hey, you know, here I am," you can't enjoy that. You know, it's actually a good karma that the potential enjoyment is there. It's also a very evil karma that would involve adultery and throw you to hell. You know, so you can't. I mean, you can't enjoy everything that presents itself. But if it's not immoral, it doesn't hurt anyone. And you can't avoid it. It will come to you somehow. That's part of
what is practice. What are the five? Yeah. Did you say there are five poisons?
Three
poisons.
One is desire in the sense of not wanting to be separated from a desirable object.
Yeah.
The other is what they translate as anger, which I think it's as simple as like and dislike, because supposedly you're
aversion.
Having this almost... Yeah, but aversion... How many times did you have aversion today? See, you had this poison all day.
Right, dislike.
Yeah, I like and dislike, yeah. Personally, because it's aversion or dislike is defined as... I think hatred is a real bad translation. Defined as simply wanting to be separated from an undesirable object. So it can be as minor as running through the rain.
Uncomfortable.
You know, or shifting in your chair. I mean,
So it is wanting to be separated from
you. Yeah. I mean, you know, when you have a person at work who bothers you, that's the nyomon, that's the klesha, that's the bad thought that comes up in your mind. I'd like to get out of here.
Yeah, I think of it as going after something or getting away from something.
Yeah, it's like that. And then ignorance, which doesn't understand the implication that doesn't. Ignorance. That's the third poison. She doesn't understand the implications of desire. Meaning, wisdom would say, as we said many times, the nasty guy at work would present himself. You would see that he's empty. You'd see that he's not nasty by his own nature, because his wife looks at the same person and thinks he's great. You can't be nasty and great at the same time. Therefore, those two qualities can't be naturally attached to him. And it's coming from somewhere else. The appearance of him being nasty is coming from somewhere else. Then you study karma. You know that it's your perception. Forced on you by your past karma. Does that allow you to see him the way his wife sees him?
No.
Would you like to see him as an angel? Yes. How can you do that? Be good.
But he also said once that the person does, in reality, if the person is nasty to you, the person is being nasty to you.
He is nasty. I've never said he was
nasty. Yeah, right.
He is empty and he is nasty.
Right.
He's not real and he's really nasty.
Yeah.
It's not a contradiction. And in any other teaching about it, it's wrong. And if you don't believe it, take the next person who teaches anything else about emptiness and ask him if you can stick a needle in his arm. You know what I mean? It's just silly. Of course it hurts.
So, what was the second one, anger?
Dislike, wanting to get away from something.
Does that include like suffering and things like that? You want to get away from suffering?
Sure.
That's considered bad to want to get away from suffering?
Well, it's like this. Ignorant wanting to get away is bad. Enlightened wanting to get away is good. But how do you get away from a bad man at work? If a person at work is harming you, how do you get away from him?
You give him time.
Walk away.
Not like that. He is, if you understand emptiness, and it takes a lot of practice, and it takes logic, you have to convince yourself of something which is not at all natural to think. But he's bad because you've seen him as bad, because you have a problem, because your perceptions are forced on you by your past karma. He's not bad. He's empty. He's blank. He's blank. You're filling it in with crappy crayons. Because you have perceptions of yourself harming someone in the past. So, what is the method ultimately to remove this wart?
The wart of existence.
Well, this guy. What's the ultimate method to see, to remove this unpleasant person?
You break that perceptual cycle.
Emptiness.
You stop seeing him that way and you don't respond and generate more karma.
Much minimum, but what would
be
the
nice to them.
Love him like your mother. Love him like your wife. Have real, real deep, deep love for him. And then in the future, he must, that blank screen must become desirable.
Is it good enough to be compassionate towards the person? To understand? So this person is has been nasty to you and you say, well,
is know. Compassion, which is the fourth of the seven steps in developing bodhicitta, the cause for bodhicitta? No. You have to go way up, past that. That's way down, number four. You got to get to number six and seven. We went through that. We don't have time for that.
Is that all?
Compassion a form of love, though?
Yeah, but it has to even go higher. Yeah.
Does that include all sentient beings?
If that you approach? Want to go to a paradise, or would you rather have 20% be muggers and crappy
people? Well, let's say,
you have a choice. Yeah, you're only nice to 50% of the people.
Let's say.
I'd say you'll probably go to a place where only 50% of people are good.
Let's say cancer or HIV virus. Are supposed to be loving toward your wives?
It's not. We don't say it's a living being.
It's a living. Okay.
Why not?
How far?
I don't know. I don't know what a virus is in Buddhist cosmology. An amoeba would be. Yeah. An amoeba, a cancer.
Bacteria.
I didn't say it's not a bad thing. I did not say it doesn't hurt you. I will not say it will even kill you. What I'm saying is that your attitude towards it determines what it will be in the future. You can't change what it is now easily. It's possible, but it takes a great Buddhist practice, which you will learn some time. But right now, you cannot change its nature. It's apparent nature. You can understand that the dental drill is empty, but I've never said it won't hurt you. If you practice properly, its nature will change and it won't hurt you. But the will to have it not hurt you will not change it. And it never did it? So anyway, we gotta go. Dandaloke, okay? So he says, understand that everything in the world has these qualities. The good things in the world, the normal good things, they're not stable. They cause you all your suffering. And they make you discontented. It's their nature. It's their nature that any good thing you get, you want more.
Cause suffering, what would you do?
And they make you discontented. They make you want more. So that's supposed to get this in your mind. That's supposed to trigger this. Where you say, okay, I don't want these things anymore. I want something better.
When you say they make you want more, you mean more quantity is the same thing, not repeating the same experience.
I'd say that my own quantity. I can remember when I was paid $7 an hour, and I was quite happy to get the job. I was really happy to get the job. And then 8 wasn't enough, and then 9 wasn't enough, and 10 wasn't enough, and then 100,000 a year wasn't enough, and whatever wasn't enough. And it's human nature. And you give some Cambodian refugee a job and was so happy the first few weeks, and then after a year they're saying, you know, this is really lousy, I need more pay, you know. And it's human nature. It's not that they're evil or bad, or it's the nature of samsaric pleasures that you want more and better.
So, Michael, are you saying a person should not want more money?
Michael doesn't want any more money.
No, I didn't say that. What I mean to say is...
It's not what you're saying.
What I'm saying is that recognize that more money, or less money, or medium money,
okay, it's not
or no money, or lots of money, is the same state. It's suffering.
Yeah, okay.
It's all suffering.
But you still can get more money, though.
It's if you can make good use of it to keep yourself healthy, and to keep yourself in Dharma, or to give away to other people, that's fine.
Okay.
That's great.
That's good.
But is it in and of itself? By itself, it is a samsaric thing. Your body, your mind, everything about us now can only give us suffering. Its nature is to suffer. There's no... So you're telling me, should I like $50,000 worth of total suffering or $10,000 worth of total suffering? It's the same thing. you know, but obviously you need some money to practice. You should not grub off other people's heads. You should not. It's not a Buddhist practice to give up all your money and then bother people. It's a Buddhist practice to take care of your livelihood properly, honestly, without hurting anyone, and responsibly. That's your job. Okay, Pandaloke. So that was that verse that came then. Then what do you think would naturally happen after that? Once you got the desire.
Then you gotta act.
To get out. Yeah, you would try to find some way.
Is this the third to get out?
So this is the second part of the meditation for... and I want to make sure I get...
Aren't we just discussing a medium capacity person?
Yeah, and this is the second meditation for a medium capacity person. The first meditation is where he says, okay, I understand that I'm going to die. I understand that whatever I do determines where I go. But hey, wherever I go, it's a bummer. There's no... Okay, so I get born in a better place next time. Donald Trump instead of Michael Rove. But it's not a desirable thing. So I'd rather find some other kind of pleasure, some kind of permanent
pleasure.
So therefore he gets that he moves up one step in his understanding and in his motivation. Tar means what? You had it before.
Freedom.
Lam means what?
Path.
Good. Ten up, you don't know. Ten up means to determine what it is. To figure out what it is.
The whole word?
Yeah. Ten up is short for tenla appa, which means to determine or to figure out what it is. The root text says at this point, namda samba deyu tangbayu, which means use that pure thought to push you on to... What is that pure thought?
The wish
to get out of here. Okay. What is it going to be when you get out of here? I mean, are you going to go to a different place? Is that what is samsara? If samsara is defined as having this kind of body and mind, then getting out of samsara does not involve a location change. It involves a reality change. Your own nature changes.
Compressed at different aggregates.
Pure heaps.
Yeah. That's pure all. Body and a pure mind. Totally bliss and a body and mind. Permanent.
Do they say what they're a pure set of heaps? Do they describe what a pure set of heaps are?
Sure. That's the idea. You know what's the definition of nirvana.
But it doesn't say what the heaps are, though. We're saying, you know, like we have our five heaps, you know, and say, like, this heap becomes like this, this heap becomes like this.
What's the definition of nirvana?
A permanent cessation.
You get rid of all your sufferings. Yeah. Something like that. It's something
left over. Ooh, boy.
Nothing like
that. We had the definition of nirvana. That's so young.
Yeah, you've got to rid of all your sufferings.
What does that all that mean? It means it's brought on by the perception of emptiness. So it's the permanent stopping of those things.
And once you do that, then what does your format become? What does
you
your
tell me
just
two kinds.
Something left over.
Yeah, this is the weakest step. One, before you die, you still have a body caused by these things. Yeah. So you still have a body, which is impure.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you die, the nature changes. Now, that's the school that you guys studied.
My question is, when they're totally alive.
What do they look like? What are they like?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't have nyunjibs. They don't have obstacles. They don't have those six thoughts ever again.
Yeah.
And the body is made of... the body's nature changes from blood and bone and flesh to a kind of rainbow body or diamond body.
light body.
It's visible. It's totally pleasant. It has no impermanent. It's not impermanent in the sense of ever growing old.
You say it's an energetic form body, essentially.
It's visible. It has shape and color.
Visible to who?
Is it young or old?
It's visible.
Male or female?
Michael Jordan.
Neither male nor female, unless you choose it to be one or the other, to look like one or the other. Is it young or old? Actually, by that time, you have the power to make it appear any way you want.
So it's malleable. Or is it like a one-shot deal? Okay, it's going to be like that, and then it's finally, or it's just today I feel like
you. You could appear as anybody.
You could appear as anybody.
Yeah, you have the power to emanate yourself. You look like a bird or a dog.
Why would you want to go in the animal?
You should be nice with it.
Why would you want to go in the animal?
Just appear as a bird.
No.
Peep to the hunter who's about to shoot at you. Distract him.
That's true.
Okay.
If that's true, and the Dalai Lama wanted to get off of me, and he couldn't get off of me because the doctors told him he couldn't, then I don't understand what.
In the Mahayana, and again, I can't prove it to you, okay? And I admit that I can't prove it to you. I can tell you what the books say, that to make himself look more accessible to our level, he pretends to have this problem. Now, can you accept that? No. Can I prove it to you? Slowly. You'll be able to digest it eventually. Can I prove that you'll be able to digest it eventually?
Eventually.
Yes.
And for that matter, is he really eating meat or does he just appear?
Oh, no, come on.
If he is appearing, that's it. Okay, that's
what are we using for definition of Tarlam Tanap? Like a one-liner so I can memorize it?
Oh,
nice English.
Using pure thought to get out of here?
No. This is wanting to get out, and this is how to get out. Figuring out how to get out.
Figuring out what the path of freedom is?
Yeah. Establishing, literally it means to establish the path of freedom. But I don't care as long as you understand the mental process that's going on. What's been going on to your mind, and this is what your meditation should be for the next 6 months. It's very simple. It's a simple train of thoughts, and you're going to burn it into the computer screen. It's some kind of dissatisfaction to start with. Then you decide, well, I probably need a teacher to figure this whole thing out. I will get a teacher to figure it all out. I'll make sure he's qualified. And if he's qualified, I'll follow what he says. I'm going to die. I'm very lucky to be here. It's not very long. I have all these conditions working for me. I am going to die. What's going to happen after that? It depends on what I do. But even if I do something good and then I get this same kind of life again, which is extremely, the odds are extremely low. I get a life like this. But then again, I'm going to have to go through the same process of ups and downs, ups and downs. Ups and downs might be okay if you weren't getting old the whole time. But your energy level is dropping every month. And eventually you end up without any energy. And there's no one who can live very long. And anyone who does must lose his hearing, must lose his sight, must lose his teeth, must lose all his energy, must get ugly, and then get stupid, and then die. There's no other option. So why go through it again if you have a chance now to stop it and reach some really handsome level, you know? Permanently useful level. Much better. So then how can I do that? That's what we're going to talk about right now. So the text says at this point, by the way, this is a super compressed Lam Rim. I mean, the whole Lam Rim would take about Rinpoche took 12 years to teach it in New Jersey. Okay. The book says, Namdak Sambhadeya Chambayi, use this desire to get out in order to Jenda Sheshin. What is Jemba and Sheshin? Heard them before? Jhamba is recollection and Shishin is watchfulness. We had them in the practice of shamatha, of developing shamatha. But what are they aimed at in this case? Tenbe tsawa soso tarpala. The very core of Buddhist teachings, soso tarpa, the eight types of vows, the eight types of vowed morality. Okay. Number eight is monk's vows. Number one is a one-day vow. Number two and three are where a layman decides to take the five vows for his life. What are the five vows? Not killing. I will not kill in my life again. Stealing. No sexual misconduct.
Alcohol.
Lying.
Lying?
Stealing.
Killing, sexual misconduct. Lying.
No. Alcohol.
Lying in what?
Alcohol. Intoxicants. Drugs or alcohol.
All drugs. That includes doctored drugs.
No, it doesn't include alcohol included in a cough syrup or something like that.
No.
No.
Apple
juice. What? No, how do they offer caffeine?
It doesn't say caffeine or tea. In
do they say specific things other than alcohol?
The text in the Abhidharma, the text of the Abhidharma says any substance which is refined from a natural juice like wine, whiskey, alcohol basically, or which is put together through chemicals. So they mentioned that. This is like 350 AD.
Put together through like.
Or which is a chemical like LSD or heroin, which is artificially concocted, which has the function of lowering your inhibition level.
What was the first one? Fermented? Anything fermented?
Alcohol. Or drugs. I mean, and they say that. And then the Buddha in the Abhidharma Kosha lifts up a piece of grass and says to his followers, he whosoever drinks the amount of alcohol that you could put on the tip of this grass, don't call yourself a Buddhist and I'm not your teacher.
Why, Michael? Why no alcohol?
Because it lowers, its effect is to subtly lower your ability to keep your morality.
Then the alcohol, that's what the question I had the other day for you. Europeans use a lot of wine to put in their food, but there's not really an effect of alcohol when you eat the food. So is that alcohol?
If it didn't have the effect to lower the function of an intoxicant, which is prohibited, okay, is something which lowers your ability to protect your morality.
Well, I think there's a difference. You have to make a distinction between abusing things that are not necessarily designed for the specific purpose of becoming intoxicated, as for example wine or beer or what things like that, and something like cocaine or heroin, or which is designed specifically to
the Buddha said
one is a beverage,
it's
and the
about
other
intention,
is
a... Isn't it? Everybody wine, it's what the other heroin.
So you don't have to really fully high.
Teaspoon of wine, according to the scriptures, lowers your... It increases the odds of your breaking your morality eventually.
What about if you're addicted to chocolate?
You have one glass of wine.
Because it can rule your mind.
If it would lower, obviously, in an extreme case, an addiction to anything might lower your ability to not do an action which you might hurt someone to get it. Even chocolate. Is it prohibited? Prohibited because the Buddha is mean, or the Buddha is too strict, or the Buddha is like an old nun in the Catholic girls' school, or it's not like that.
No, but my point is,
it has the function of possibly causing you to do something which would have, according to the laws of karma, infinite painful effects on you. So do it with pleasure. Keep it with pleasure, be happy about it.
Is the idea of just taking a small amount? It plants a seed to do it again in the future and then more
partly,
in the future.
Partly that and partly it lowers the inhibition to take more.
But Michael, it's like if you're supposed to be watching your mind every second of the day. I mean, we talk about the black seeds and the white seeds and all of that. I mean, if every second what you're thinking, how can you monitor what you're thinking if you're taking something?
If you lower your ability, if you lower your ability to monitor by 1%, you've just caused yourself.
And that's bad. It's bad enough as it is.
So don't think of it as just forget it. It's useless. Poop. I almost said a bad word. There's no benefit for you. It costs money. It's useless. It has no benefit for you. If there's a chance in 1,000 that it could make you less watchful, why bother? Well, what's the big deal? What's so great about it?
What if you're more relaxed and then you're more watchful? What if you're overly agitated and a glass of wine makes you calm down enough to pay more attention?
Pump iron.
Use the count your breath, I think it was.
What about salt? You can't speak and count your breath at the same time.
Michael, what about...
You know, I've always found that when I start to lose it, you know, if you say I'd rather go to another room and recollect and
think about death.
Recollect myself.
Yeah.
People don't like it. But if you say I have to go to the bathroom, nobody stops you. I can be in the worst meeting with my boss. He's about to say something important, and I'll say, look, you've got to go to the bathroom. And I've never had anyone say, no, don't go, sit down, you know. So go to the bathroom and sit down and collect yourself. Collect yourself.
So what did we say the eight vows, types of vows?
I didn't get to
that. I'm sorry, there was one, number 23.
What I'm trying to tell you is that the recollection and the watchfulness that he's mentioning here are not focused on the object of meditation. These are the same mental functions, but they are focused on your morality. They are with you throughout the day, monitoring. I like that word that she chose. They are monitoring your behavior throughout the day. Is it? Should you feel guilty? Are you a bad person? You know? Should you, you know, blah blah blah? Go home. Should you give up all your friends and tell them you don't want to stay with them anymore? It's not the thing. Most of the immorality that we do are things that are quite acceptable in society. Talking bad about people at work. Subtly trying to split people up. Looking at another guy's wife. I've done it, but basically I'll say this. If I remember correctly, wrong object, okay? Your mother, your sister, a nun, etc. And another person's spouse. Wrong place. In a room where there's an altar. Near a temple. Around your lama. Within earshot of other people. Etc. Wrong organ. Anal, oral, masturbation, etc. Wrong... What's the last one?
Time.
Wrong what?
Time.
Wrong time. Yeah, lady is having her period. Yeah. She's pregnant. Any time when it would hurt her physically.
Daylight.
To do it.
You mean what happens?
No open daylight.
You cannot have your fear of your period. If it hurts.
What about daylight?
Well, specifically if it hurt the person. It's even, and it's just more of daylight would be considered shameless in a way. It would be considered so. And that some lamas say that. The book says that. We went through, was there anything? I don't know. Homosexuality is considered sexual misconduct.
Not for the Dalai Lama, said in the last, I read an article where he...
He's explicit. I just read it today.
Yep.
Scriptures are explicit as well.
Oh, wow.
But he said it. You know, this is Abel Pitesh Bar.
He said it.
Scriptures are quite explicit.
Yeah, but why would he say it? He said, it's fine. It's not considered sexual misconduct if you haven't taken your monastic vows. That's what he says right now.
It is considered.
Well, why would he say that?
Where did he say it?
No, he said it. I mean, unless they misquoted it. It's in a quotation. I haven't said it.
I know that this came out.
Right.
Now, if you were pressed to substantiate that, or did he say it to reach a certain audience, or for other reasons.
One can always use those.
Yeah, and this is, any teacher does that. The Buddha himself taught four schools of Buddhism. Three of them are flatly wrong. So why did he teach them? We will study this subject, and we'll also study how to determine when he's doing it and when he's not doing it. There are rules for when he should do it, and we'll study that. It's a whole subject called Dharma. It's called the art of interpretation. And
But this is it has to do with like when you interpret a statement symbolically,
yeah,
or
when the Buddha says, "Kill your father."
How do you?
I mean, obviously that's metaphoric. Now, when are in other circumstances? When is he saying what is really the case ultimately, and when is he saying something to which is not true, but which is meant to bring along someone who needs to be brought along a little farther? The Abhidharma is not true. The mind-only school is not true. The South Chandrika school, all the Buddhist logic and perceptual schools are not true. The Lower Madhyamika school is not true. And that's a fact.
Which is the school that's true?
I am the school. Now, are they all parts of them wrong? No. Are central tenets of them wrong? Yes. So why did he teach them? Because those people couldn't relate to him. He couldn't bring them along further if he didn't say certain things, which, technically speaking, are not true. Now, is the Dalai Lama doing that here? We would have to sit down and thrash it out. We'd have to apply those rules of interpretation.
But if you translate that to the level of personal action, and you start out talking about morality in terms of not wanting to create a situation where you ascetically clamp down on yourself, but rather attempt to root out the cause underlying the desire, whether it's, you know, which ultimately is ignorance rather than desire itself, then it almost seems to me that the whole point is that you're not trying to establish an outward situation of rules that you must follow, but rather set up, you know, certain overall directions you should be aiming in. So that the reason Dalai Lama would say that is because he knows that to be a hard ass, sorry, at that point, is to alienate this entire readership.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He's going, well, no, come along, come in, and then somewhere along the line, perhaps you come to some other conclusion.
Somewhere along the line, he might make them kind of essential. Somewhere along the line, further, he might make them
celibate.
You see?
Say that again,
Michael.
No more
money. Somewhere along the line, he'll make homosexual heterosexual. Perhaps this is the... And then somewhere along the line, it's, it really is. And it's just a matter of time. But do you force it...
That seems a rather monastic
perspective.
I'm not saying monastic.
So if we're all celibate, there'll be no more samsara, there'll be no more life.
I mean,
not true. No, not true. You could have all the sexual activity going on you want. No being had the karma to have to take another samsaric birth. You wouldn't give birth. It's not your doing, it's his karma.
Do you think you could finish this lesson and make another class about this?
One last question.
Well, I was just going to say, with the view of emptiness, nothing is inherently good or bad, right?
Not true.
Pardon me?
Not true. Not in morality.
Not in morality. Mm-hmm. So no matter who it was, anyone who did one of these things that you're talking about, the effect would be the same.
No, I didn't say
or is it that to the vast majority of people who would be hearing this message, you're better off for the time being in the state that you're in right now to avoid certain activities.
People who are not
because
not
of the state of your mind.
Reach nirvana, if they want to establish the path to reach nirvana, must keep Sheshin and Temba on one of the eight types of vows.
If
the
you time
don't
being,
have one
least.
Of the eight types of vows, you can just consider the ten non-virtues. Avoid the ten non-virtues.
Did you just infer that you can't attain nirvana without one of the eight types of vows?
No, but he's defined the method of the path as watching your morality, and he happens to have mentioned the eight types of vows. Is it impossible to reach nirvana without taking formal vows and keeping them? I'm not sure. Hmm. I know that when you take a vow to keep something and you keep it, its nature completely changes. So, Yeah, those five are not so hard.
Are those five vows, are those the layman's vows?
Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and use of alcohol.
And you said that 2 and 3 is the layman vows, and they yeah. all incorporate the five?
Yeah, 2 and 3, 2 is for ladies, 3 is for men. 5 vows for your life. And then they go on, then you get into the realm of ordained people, and there's female novice, male novice, female advanced novice, female nun, and a full monk. And those are the 8.
And if you don't keep your sexual morality, can you advance higher states?
Okay, what?
If you don't, you know, follow that. If you sexually, if you're not, if you misconduct yourself.
I think, eventually you have to reach nirvana, you eventually have to keep your morale.
Yeah, but I mean, can you at least...
can you make progress in other places? Sure. Sure. Absolutely. You're supposed to work on the one which bothers you the most. But obviously, if you make advances in reducing your anger, by the way, then it will also help reduce your desire. I mean, any advance you make towards digging away at any of your problems, it helps you to overcome your other problems. So work on, they say work on your worst one first. But even if you can't, then work on any of them, and it will help you work on your worst. Okay, we got to move on. Do you want to turn on the water?
Excuse me, I'm just not clear what the 8 are. The first one was the monk bells, and then the next 5.
You don't. It's not on your homework or anything. But if you want to know, there's three kinds of layman's vows. The first one is male or female one day vow.
Is that under the vows? If you do it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Can you just say you just said number 1 or something different?
One day vow.
Set of vows number 1 consists of the male or female one-day vow. Set of vows number 2 is the female lifetime layman's vow, which consists of 5 rules.
Is the content different as between the one-day vow and the lifetime vow, so that in each category?
No. The third vow. And why do they include them in one vow and they split the rest into male and female? Because it's only one day. It's not a big deal. Okay, set of vows number 3. A lifetime man, layman, 5 rules. Set of vows, so number 2 is for ladies, number 3 is for men. Number 2 and number 3 are to keep the same vows.
Can I switch the 2?
Want to say again?
No, I could have been men 2 and ladies 3.
Yeah. Under certain circumstances. But not in the... this is the way it's taught, and I...
on. Okay.
When we get to higher teachings and the ladies come first, I'll complain too. All right. Number 4. Ladies, novice, vows. Ordained. Number 5. Man's, novice, vows. Ordained. Number 6. Advanced ladies, novice, vows. Number 7. Nun's vows. Full nun. Number 10. Full nun. Number 8. Full nun. Sorry.
Fully ordained.
There's an asymmetry in there.
There's three advanced males, novice, vow.
That's
really true. Don't ask me why. It's not our subject. Though. Okay, anyway. One day vow for man or woman.
But nuns were never fully ordained.
Yeah, the vow that exists in the world today is for women. The vow that Dhamma has is number 4.
Isn't there something that Tibetan Buddhist nuns can only get in the Theravada tradition?
It's being researched by a committee right now.
But there has to be
whether or not in our tradition we're going to accept
reviving it though, no?
No, it would be just picking up on a continuum that we weren't aware of until now.
Oh, thought that had
if it can be established that it was never broken in the last 1100 years.
Good luck.
Now, why did he mention morality? Why did he? There's three trainings, right? What are they?
Concentration.
Morality, concentration, and wisdom.
Concentration.
Reaching nirvana is the practice of removing your bad thoughts permanently. Why did he only mention morality? Doesn't it take all three trainings to remove your bad thoughts permanently?
Morality is
the
foundation.
Yeah, morality is like what he means when he mentions morality only is that it's to imply the other two. You must have concentration, meditative concentration, and you must have wisdom. But he mentions morality why? What's the relationship between morality and concentration?
You can't concentrate without morality.
You can't concentrate with something on your conscience, and you never will be able to.
Is that just a guilt thing? Or?
It's the nature of a bad taste. It interrupts the psychic being. He can't. He will. He will not be able to achieve very high shamatha as long as he's got some bad deed that he has not purified.
So you got to do massive purification to really
That's
get
the whole anyone. Idea of the preparation for meditation. That's the whole point of doing those preliminaries before you meditate.
I mean, if we've got a bazillion lifetimes of bad deeds and we're going to do, you know, like 5 minutes of confession before each meditation session, what are we talking here?
No, you do as pure as you can. The purer you make yourself, the better the meditation.
So with that ration, wouldn't it be better to do, you know, months and years of purification before you try to do a serious retreat?
It might be. They say do as much as you can, but it's not practical. I mean, it's not that you won't be able to make it. If you do a good chakra, good purification on your main problems, you'll be able to have a good meditation. Okay. And how does that lead into concentration? You can't perceive emptiness directly if you're not in a state of shamatha, deep meditation. So he mentions morality, knowing that his intelligent listeners will say, oh yes, but I must have concentration and wisdom also. How does it apply to the guy at work?
You keep your morality with the guy at work.
You asked me what to do about, what was it? Something unpleasant. The question came from Mark. It was a good question. How does the Dalai Lama enjoy himself? What's the nature of the guy at work? You see, the whole Tarlam is contained in that incident with the guy at work. That's it. That's the whole answer right there. He hurts you. What do you do back? What I'm saying is the reaction cannot be related to his action. The content of the reaction must be totally divorced from his action. If he had spoken to you nicely, if he had said to you, the worst insult you've ever had, if he hit you or if he caressed you, the reaction must be the same. Your reaction must be the same.
So with that logic, anytime you
does it mean you don't punch a guy in the face? Absolutely not. With great motherly love. Punch him in the face. Seriously?
Yeah, no, I'm
thanks.
Sure.
Thanks.
No, but my point was is that then in terms of a skillful response would always...
I would say the intelligent response and what the Dalai Lama calls it. What do you call it?
Enlightened
self-interested response. There's only one.
It would be to always take harm.
Well, that would be a side effect of loving him.
Right. So then, assuming you're not going to respond and hurt him in a compassionate way.
You could hurt him in
it. Assuming you're not going to do that, then the only other response left is to take harm that's given to you
and respond
and never give harm back.
Unless
it's based on compassion.
Unless you're stupid. Yeah. Unless you don't understand emptiness. Yeah. If you don't understand emptiness, hurting back. That reaction is stupid. It will cause a perception which will be planted in your mind stream, which must result in you perceiving a blank object in the future as unpleasant. And you don't want that.
Yeah, but let's take the Chinese soldier that cuts off the mouth.
And it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult. You can know all this stuff. You can teach it to other people for years. And then the guy at work yells at you, and it's all gone. You know?
Yeah, because you figure he deserves it to get the response that you give him.
Yeah. But by the way, even in a worldly way, the opposite response is very constructive, and it works very well.
Opposite.
You usually get what you want, actually. But it's not the reason to do that. Have some...
What about the Chinese soldier that cuts off the hands of monks? How is the monk supposed to react to a Chinese soldier?
But the ultimate it's not the soldier that's
hurting. The jelly is the hole.
It's not the soldier.
His own car. Yeah, but he's praying on purpose. That's the reason why he's passing.
I think that's jelly and peanut butter.
Should he be angry at the knife or should he be angry at the soldier?
No, he should. He shouldn't be angry at either. He should prevent that soldier from cutting off.
Have you got sweets?
Oh, if it's out of compassion for a soldier, for sure.
Where have you been?
You should do whatever you can.
Yeah, we've been in New York.
I've been to work today.
But if the time comes, that he can't anymore.
That's
it happens in scripture. We're on to the meditations for a person of the great scope.
Well, that's fine. Can you summarize the medium scope? It's
yeah, medium
real
scope,
brief.
We just had two steps, you know. Find out what's...
Want it and get it.
Want it, that's nice.
And how do you go about getting it?
Get it. He said, focus on your morality with watchfulness and with recollection. What he meant was, focus on your morality to develop a higher state of concentration, which allows you to see emptiness directly, which will stop your bad thoughts forever. That's nirvana. That's tantra. That's moksha. Okay. By the way, given the example of the person at work, it's quite simple. That's the answer. That's the practical application of that principle. He does something to harm you, and you stop reacting forever. So there's nothing to throw this into being, or to throw the perception of this into being, which is the same as throwing it into being. And we learn about that. And by the way, it's only because of that distinction that it's possible. What you're actually stopping forever is the future perception of seeing yourself having such a body in mind. That's connected to the emptiness. That's the whole... You want to achieve nirvana, that's the whole thing.
So you would have the body in
with,
mind?
With knowledge... React to the person at work with knowledge. Where is your dharma going to take place? Where are the causes for your nirvana going to be planted? You know, what is the battlefield on which you will fight this battle? It's your office. Where did you think it was going to be? It's in your life. Those are the places where you're going to have to do it. It's a perfect place. Fertile field.
Plenty of manure.
Yeah, try to get into a busy office with lots of greedy people around you. Great. Okay. And if you don't have those people, you're not going to get much chance. Sit in a monastery. It's much better to go and be around all these desire objects and all these anger objects.
It's hard.
No, but it's... But sooner or later, you're going to have to...
But if it's harder, that means it's better.
Well, if you've got the strength not to fail. If you don't have the strength not to fail, go get thee to a nunnery.
Okay. Take quarantine for a while.
Back to habit.
Oh boy. Okay, go home now. Two parts to man.
So two parts to what?
These are going to be the two parts to the big person's practice. I can find it. What does Changsha mean? Chang is body, Sam is chitta.
Mind.
Chang Sam. Buddha mind, which is not Buddha mind, right? It's the desire to become a Buddha. It has nothing to do with the Buddha state of mind, right? Bodhicitta does not ever have anything to do with the Buddha's own state of mind. It's the wish to become a Buddha.
So Buddhas never have bodhicitta. Is that what you're
saying? Oh, no, not yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
They do, remember?
Keto means how to develop it.
So what's
the other one, renunciation? Number two? I mean medium capacity.
It's throughout. It's really throughout. It starts with not wanting to go to the lower realms, right? But true renunciation, okay, so how to develop the wish to become a Buddha so that you can help all other living beings. To become a Buddha so that you can help all other living beings.
How to become a Buddha.
How to develop the wish to become a Buddha so that you can help all other living beings. I'll give it to you in 30 seconds or less.
Don't you have to develop the urge like in the middle scope first?
You know, the middle These are scope. All.
In the middle scope, you develop the urge and then you act. Here, you don't have to develop the urge and then
this
act.
This is the urge, then you're going to have the act. Chunk Sam is only the urge.
Oh, I thought that was the act. Okay.
No.
It's the wish.
This is the wish. So what it is mainly this. It's quite coldly logical. If it's true that your present conscious moment of consciousness must be produced by the moment of consciousness in the moment before. Okay? If your consciousness here had to be the cause of your consciousness here, which is true, mind has to come from mind. Mind has to come from the mind of the moment before. The fact that you are aware has to come from the fact that you were aware a minute ago. If that's true, if it's true, don't say it's true. If it's true, then you had a past life.
Well, that's right, because it also has to be because the fact that you were aware 10 minutes ago is simultaneously, right?
The awareness you had at the moment of conception had to be preceded by a principal cause consisting of a state of consciousness. We'll talk about it later. I mean, but that's the proof of formula. That's the only proof of formula. If that's true, then you've had countless former lives, and I can jump like that. If that's true, then I have been everything to you before, and you have been everything to me before. Mm. I've been your mother trillions of times, I've been your worst enemy trillions of times, I've murdered you trillions of times, you've murdered me trillions of times. So we concentrate on the trillions of times that you have taken care of me, like my mother did in this life. So then it's my duty to pay you back. And that's basically bodhicitta. You know, what have you done for me lately? is a person less kind to you because they were equally kind to you 2 years ago than they were last year? I mean, you see what I mean? Does it really matter that time has gone by? Does kindness know the bounds of time? You know, are you less obligated to pay a person back who gave you $1,000 last year than one who gave you $1,000 this year if you were dying without that $1,000? You know, it's not at all. You're equally obligated to each person. Simple. So I just gave you all the proofs you need. every person has been equally kind to you. There's a matter of now or a year ago or 1,000 years ago, and it's your duty to help them.
But isn't there something you're forgetting about beginning? That's we have never really gotten through it, you know?
We'll discuss it in the next course, okay. And I promise.
Can you repeat one sentence? The awareness that you had at the moment of conception had to be preceded by, and the word principle was in the subsequent.
It had to be preceded by a moment of awareness which was acting as its principal cause.
Thank you.
Okay. In other words, rock don't turn into mind.
Life produces life.
Mind produces mind. Principal cause, not talking secondary causes. All right. And we'll probe it in the next course. Okay.
Where was that next one?
Chöpa means the activities and meaning the activities of a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva activities. Oh, I'm sorry. How to train in the bodhisattva activities. How to learn how to act like a bodhisattva. Yeah. How to learn how to act like a bodhisattva. How to learn acting like a bodhisattva. Bodhisattva's activities have... No, this is Tibetan. Bodhisattva activities, there are two types. Basically two types. Do means non-secret, open. Okay. Open bodhisattva activity.
Meaning it is what it appears.
No. It's not tantra. Nak means tantra. Nak means tantra, and tantra means secret bodhisattva activities.
So tantra is, what is that, Sanskrit for secret?
It literally means a thread.
Tantra means thread?
Yeah, and it was comes from a thread that Brahmins used to wear around there. But there's a long story about it. So open bodhisattva activities and secret bodhisattva activities. We can't talk about this one.
No.
Well, we can see it, though.
Okay, this goes on here.
So it literally refers to tantra.
The literal is mantra. Okay.
Right.
Nak means mantra.
But as distinct from, say, things, doing things in such a way that your actual purpose in doing them may be hidden from the view of most people.
I'm not going to explain what secret means.
No, but I'm saying...
I'll tell you one thing, it's not what most people think.
No, I'm talking... Maybe
I'm talking about more
helpful. No, I'll go one step further. What I'm saying is that these activities are of such a nature that they are secret by their nature.
No, I'm not talking about that category. I'm talking about the previous category or a different category. When you say open activities, do you mean right there in the open, everybody can interpret it as being bodhisattva activity?
That's not what I mean by open. No.
Okay,
I
that's
mean
what
that
I'm
you
asking.
Don't need permission to practice them, and you
non-secret.
It's a long story. Okay.
What were you going to say about Nak?
What I'm saying is that Nak is secret by nature. If you don't have the goodness to practice it, you can open all the books and someone can tell you everything that's in the books and you can hear everything that anyone ever done in Nak, and nothing will happen. You won't see anything. If you, you don't have the proper training and the proper permission, authorization, and the proper practices and the proper lam rim in your heart, you can be around all the knock you want. You won't see anything. Nothing will happen. It doesn't matter. It's secret by its nature. It's not that anyone has to hide it from you. You'll never see nothing. Nothing will happen. You could desecrate all those tantric books you want by opening them and reading them, and nothing will happen to you.
So really the meaning of tantra and secrecy is that if you don't have the goodness and the training, it's secret, you won't...
It's secret by its nature. It will be hidden from you.
It's an elite awareness, then.
Yeah, you need long
you don't get it.
You need those other things. What are they? Understanding how to take a teacher, how to follow him. Understanding how lucky you are and why you should practice Dharma. Understanding that you will die. Understanding about the laws of karma that will throw you where they're going to throw you. Being fed up with this life, understanding how nothing can make you happy, taking the steps to get that are necessary to get out of this life, which are the three trainings, morality, concentration, and wisdom, seeing that everyone's been your mother, wanting to help them, and then undertaking the activities that are necessary to help them. If you don't have those as experiential attitudes and realizations in your heart, it will always be secret towards you by its nature. You will never see it. So it's really, Tantra doesn't need the protection of locks and keys. You know, it's protected by goodness, by its nature. You will never see it.
And how do you develop all those realizations in your heart? By meditation?
Next 6 months. At least know them. At least run that, burn it through your brain, you know, hundreds and hundreds of times. And then that's the purpose of having a class.
Just to get the information.
Get the information, but I can't practice with you. You must.
Well, that's my question.
Go home and practice.
Is it purely the meditation? And living?
Not at all. I told you about the office.
You got to read it. Yeah, all right.
Okay. Okay, though. Two categories to that and we're done.
Dough.
And me.
Practicing in the long room, it's taught us the general perfections, the six perfections. They are what?
Morality,
generosity,
giving,
morality.
Like protecting someone from a mother is a form of giving. That's one kind of giving. So, okay, giving,
morality.
Joyful
effort.
Patience in the sense of a word that we don't have in English, which means not getting angry when the time comes. It doesn't mean being patient while the bus is coming. Patience has a lot of meanings in it. The third perfection is not getting angry when all the conditions are right. Someone has screamed at you at work and you don't get angry. That's the third perfection. Number four?
Joyful effort.
Effort, which is defined as being happy about doing the right thing.
Concentration.
Number five?
Concentration.
Meditative concentration. Shamatha, if you will.
Say that last one again. Vipassana.
Vipassana is the Pali, and it's a corruption of the Sanskrit vipassana,
which is wisdom,
which is the highest form of wisdom. Now, since you asked, since it's your last question, I'm going to give you the definitions of shamatha and vipassana. Oh. So in the future, you'll always know if what somebody says is vipassana and samatha.
Okay. Can I ask one question? When you say concentration, does it only refer to samadhi? Is that the definition of concentration? Is samadhi concentration?
When they teach the last two perfections in the long room, the fifth one is always shamatha.
Which is the king of samadhi.
Perfection is called samatha. And we went through that in the first class. Okay. Shini is defined as... shamatha. Sorry. That's the Tibetan. Shamatha. S-H-A-M-A. I prefer T-A. The reason people spell it with T-H-A is not because it's the, but because it's a different Sanskrit T, and that's the only way to show it in English, and it's not necessary to show it in English because you're not showing that T. You can't show that T. T by itself is that T. Okay. Some people misspell it with just S-A-M because somebody misspelled it diacritical, and it's the wrong spelling. Okay? It's S-H-A-M-A-T-A. If you want to add T-H-A, I won't mark it off, but it's not correct. Okay, because so many people do it. Okay. By the power. Of being in deep meditation, one pointedly on its object.
Oh.
I'm trying to translate. Can I adjust that?
Yeah.
Change it.
That single-mindedness. I'm going to start over. That single-minded state of mind.
Okay.
That'll come later. Okay. I'll start over, okay? That single-mindedness.
That.
T-H-A-T, single-mindedness. Sorry, I don't have a word. That single-mindedness. Which is imbued with I-M-B-U-E-D. You can say full of. The exceptional bliss of. Now I gotta ask you a question. You gotta help me on the word. It's that word for agility, or what do you want to guys use?
Lines. Dexterity.
Facility.
Skill.
Pliancy. Skill. Pliancy.
Pliancy. Pliancy. Does everybody know what pliancy is?
Yes.
Pliancy.
It's where you're so good at something you can make your mind do anything, jump through hoops, and you can make your body meditate all day long. And
second nature.
Control.
Okay. Exceptional. That single-mindedness which is full of the exceptional bliss of pliancy.
Bliss
of
pliancy?
Pliancy? The exceptional bliss
of pliancy?
What do you want to use? It's a suppleness which occurs because of constant.
Suppleness of mind.
Suppleness of mind. Ability.
Up there, you guys can put anything. Okay. We'll call it flexibility.
Practiced ease.
I love.
That's the best.
Okay.
I like pliancy better.
Due to.
This is a novel.
Due to deep meditation.
Here we go.
Due to deep single-pointed meditation. Do a character. on its object. That's a definition of shamatha. Basically, a very deep state of meditation in which you are also totally full of the advanced bliss which you get from being one pointed on the object. Could be physical and it is physical and mental. That's the definition of shamatha. Okay, definition of vipassana. Definition of insight.
V-I-S.
I like the V-I-P-A-S-H. Why don't you put it on the board? This is the correct Sanskrit spelling.
Y-A-I.
Vit. Vash.
I mean, it looks like Faust.
Which means inside.
That wisdom, which is full of exceptional bliss, of practiced ease, by power of
start over again.
No, so we're okay. By power of what do we call that kind of analysis? Individual analysis. By power of the individual analysis of its object, comma. By the way, if you've never heard of individual analysis, ask somebody who was in the last course. And which is founded upon quietude, which is shamatha. So I'll just, you don't have to write this down, but just so you know, basically, it's a kind of wisdom. It has mental and physical bliss. It's investigating the emptiness of its object, and it's coupled with the highest state of meditation, shamatha.
So that it's perceiving emptiness directly?
It doesn't say that. It says it's examining its object. So individual analysis.
It's examining the emptiness of its object.
But that's what you're looking for.
Either directly or indirectly or only one.
It seems to imply either.
I thought individual analysis was... And you came out of emptiness,
right.
But this is saying of another object other than that.
Yeah, it looks like that.
So what does that mean?
Of its object. It means it's a long story. It can be focused on any object.
So then when you come down, you're not
you're
saying...
You're investigating the emptiness of your object.
And
okay. It's not here the post-direct shunita investigation.
Seeing for all
it's not that. Not that. No, you can just maybe say analysis rather than individual.
Yeah, because that
you
means
might get confused. Yeah. Okay. Now there was one more question on the. I'm tricking you, right? On the homework, which I didn't tell you.
Last
so Kapa mentions the three moralities in his poem that you have in the back of your notebook. What are the three moralities?
Same as the three trainings?
No. You guys,
body speech.
What are the three kinds of vows?
So you got the Hinayana, Mahayana, and
vowed morality, which we said the eight. Vowed morality.
Bodhisattva
vows and secret vows. That's not what he's talking about here.
No.
That's why I put it on the homework. Because I always used to wonder, what's he talking about? Didn't seem to be the right place for it.
This is three vows.
Yeah, it's not the three vows. The homework even says, warning, these are not the same as the three types of vows.
So how do you distinguish
so
these
what are
three?
They?
Three what kind of
morality? Tell us already.
First kind of morality is restraining yourself from bad deeds. Now I'm talking about the three kinds of morality rather than the three kinds of vows.
So these aren't vows, they're just moralities.
No, right. They're all called morality. The first one happens to be restraining yourself from breaking your three kinds of vows. Okay, all right. It's morality in the sense that you're restraining yourself from bad deeds. The second one is called the morality of collecting goodness. So it's not really morality at all, in a sense. It's collecting personal goodness.
Humility merit. Same idea?
Yeah, but it's called morality, okay? So in the text, Tsongkhapa is talking about three moralities. I don't want you to get confused. You'll see it in the text. The third kind of morality is called morality for the sake of all sentient beings. And that's to do the other two kinds of morality, not for yourself, but for the sake of others.
I'm sorry, this is part of three?
Yeah, the morality number three is called morality for the sake of all other beings. And it's to do the first two kinds, you know, but with the motivation to help others, and not out of a selfish motivation. And I'm sorry to overload you, but we had to get to the whole Om Rim in two classes.
What are the last two perfections?
Very amazing, deep. Last two perfections are the two I gave you the definitions for.
Shamatha and Vipassana?
Yeah.
Those are perfections.
Those are the last two perfections?
Yeah. Oh, good to know. Commonly called the perfection of concentration and the perfection of wisdom.
So how are those different than the general last five and six perfections?
The last two are so important. Perceiving emptiness directly is such a threshold.
This is the end of Class 10.